You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. Now, this episode is really exciting. It's about sensory science in product development. It's easily my favourite area of food science, and it's the nearest science gets to magic in my book. We've assembled a fantastic panel to explore this. They are going to introduce themselves and tell us what their favourite sensory experience is, starting with Charlotte.
Hello, my name's Charlotte Catignani. I'm the Research and Development Manager at Treat, and we make flavour and fragrance ingredients that have a multi-sensory mechanism of action. My favourite sensory experience, I think, probably speaks to what I've been doing this weekend. It's that feeling of when you're presented with a cold beer with the condensation dripping down the side of the glass on a hot summer's day, ideally after a nice run.
Like it.
My name's Joseph Youssef, and I'm the founder and chef patron of Kitchen Theory. We're an experienced design studio, and we spend a lot of our time working with academics, scientists, and beyond, looking at how we appreciate flavor and taste in the brain, and bringing these insights from the lab onto the table.
And your favorite sensory experience?
And my favorite sensory experience, making pasta. I really like the whole thing, everything from the mixing the eggs in, but you know, using your hands, and it's one of those things where you get messy and you're allowed to be messy.
It's the it's touch, enjoyable. The touch of it all.
Yeah.
I like it. Okay.
I'm Barry Smith. I'm the director of the Centre for the Study of the Senses, and we look at all sorts of multi-sensory interactions from a scientific and philosophical point of view. My favourite sensory experience always has to be a multi-sensory experience, I think. It's usually whenever you get the sounds, the smells, the sights, and the taste and flavours right. And I love being in the quiet of a beautiful wine cellar in a very good chateau or domain where the odours are just right. You can smell the barrels, you can smell the wine, you know, you can hear the clink of the glasses coming as they're about to pour them. And I think you should never buy a wine in the cellar. You should also buy it when you're in a much less multi-sensory environment.
And Andrew Wardlaw, I lead Insight at MMR Research Worldwide. It's a consumer research agency. So one summer, I took myself off to a volcano for a holiday, Stromboli, if anyone's heard of it. Quite ungetatable, but it was a week of meditation on a volcano. And we learnt a chocolate meditation. So you take quite an intense, dark chocolate and you place it on your tongue and you're not to chew. You just let it melt, and over those 10 to 15 minutes, you get an array of sensory experiences as the different flavour notes come through. And it certainly takes your mind off other things.
Chocolate meditation, yeah. I love that. Yeah. So my favourite sensory perception experience is popping candy, which shows you how sophisticated I am. okay, now I better just sort of set the scene here. There's been a huge disruption with the food and within the food and drink industry. And consumer demand for more sustainable, healthier food products is on the rise as they look to shift their dietary habits, especially to things like more plant-based and meat-free alternatives. Now, the industry is meeting demand with lots of new product development, innovation, especially in plant-based alternative proteins, meats, and healthier options for food. So the question is, what role can sensory science play in the development of these new food solutions? Now, disruptive food design technology is all well and good, but success inevitably comes down to the question of taste, or does it? I guess that's what we're asking, really. Today's podcast will explore what role sensory science plays in product development. Barry, maybe could you just sort of start us off with, in case somebody has been living under a rock, what do we see as sensory science?
So we're looking at all the things that affect your experience of eating, and that might be what's going on just inside the head. Taste, touch, smell, the way they integrate with each other. They modulate each other's workings. We know that how something feels can affect how it tastes. We know that how something smells can affect how it feels. So those are the ways in which we've got to break down what seems like a very quick experience. You chew, you sip, you swallow, you say, I like it, I don't like it. But a lot of things had to go on sensorially to provide that experience. And we can modulate their workings to give a different experience. That's just the intrinsic qualities of eating. There's also the extrinsic characteristics. What's the packaging like? What's the look of the food? What's the smell before you eat it? What are the sounds that it makes when you're unwrapping or when you're snapping the chocolate bar or when you're melting something or pouring a drink? So all of these factors go into the overall experience of eating, but sensory science has to separate out the intrinsic and the extrinsic. We should look at the signs of the senses to look at what's actually happening in your head and around it. But you should also look at the context, and that involves things that are cultural, things that are expectations
in your wine cellar.
In your wine cellar, but also cultural expectations. I mean, one of the favorite examples is our friend and colleague Charles Spence, who talks about this. In South America, lemons are green and limes are yellow. Now, if you were giving someone the expectation that you're going to have a lime, you know, you're giving them the wrong expectation if you use our color coding in Latin America. So context matters, but it's culturally inflected.
Yeah. And so everybody here in this room has dealt with exactly this. So is it about tricks? Is it about playing? Is it about exploring things that haven't been done before? Joseph, you're serving people every day food, and you get the advantage of seeing their reactions right there. And then are you mucking about with things?
No, but that's the thing is, everyone thinks when you talk about multisensory experiences, it sounds very gimmicky, right? I mean, that's the whole very fine line you have to tread when you're looking at taking really good research and finding practical applications for it. You want to do it in ways that actually people find really engaging, really educational, but not gimmicky. And I think a lot of what we kind of, the way we look at it is, all the research that's going on isn't necessarily discovering new ways to manipulate your perception. It's more looking at the kind of existing mechanisms that are there and just looking at how through augmentations in those, like Barry was saying, talking about changing color or changing the sound or the smell or any of those sensory elements or sensory touch points, how you can actually alter someone's perception, enjoyment, of any dish or product that they may be consuming. And I think that's the really important thing, is it's not about looking at quirky kind of pseudoscience to maybe, you know, only enhance the entertainment factor of consuming the product. It is also about looking at how you can actually enhance their sensory enjoyment and pleasure. And if you enhance the sensory enjoyment and pleasure that people have, perhaps that makes them more mindful. If they're more mindful of what they eat, perhaps they eat more healthily, less, whatever. You know.
Okay, so here's a question. Can you make a rubbish dish good? I know you wouldn't do that. I know that's not your game, but you know, can you make something mediocre into something special by playing with the tricks around it?
Well, there are plenty of chefs online who, I'm not sure, there's a lot of food porn on there. God knows how good half of it tastes, but I think there's a lot to be said for if you can make a dish look really appealing to the eye, that goes a long way in terms of setting people's expectations that they want to enjoy what they're about to consume. But no, the point is very much that if cooking all starts with having, you know, I guess, great products and sensory flavor perceptions, about looking at how you can actually bring out the most in those, make more salient in people's minds the textures, smells, flavors that are associated with that eating experience and get them to enjoy it more, get them to. But it all starts with, but what I do think you can do is get maybe people to eat things that they didn't think that they would enjoy, but through using the sensory science, actually get
go on, give us an example.
Jellyfish.
Anyone here had jellyfish before?
Yep. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Go on then. Who can put words on the experience of eating jellyfish, Charlotte?
It was delicious. I had jellyfish at Kitchen Theory.
Oh, you're just sucking up to him now. So explain the texture for anyone that hasn't eaten jellyfish before.
It was almost like seaweed salad. That's why I really liked it. It had that umami, nice bit of crunch bite to it.
It's weird, isn't it? The crunch, it's sort of crunchy, tendon-like.
But that said, I mean, it's interesting. If Joseph does it, he's got umami, he's got flavour and taste in there. Something that the Chinese actually pride is just the texture. So you can take a jellyfish, you can boil and boil and boil it till it's got no flavour left at all. But as your teeth go through it, it's got that little bit of give. It feels like biting into someone's ear. There's a little bit of cartilage.
You've had experience
like
of this.
A little bit of cartilage-like give to it. But that's actually the pleasure for the Chinese. They will happily give up the flavour to have that texture.
I guess also a lot of Japanese food as well is very textural. So you know, sushi doesn't have particularly strong flavours necessarily. It's very, very textural.
The texture, and also notice that there are I think 400 words for mouthfeel in Japanese, and in English we've got about 17. So it shows you where the interest is. Now that doesn't mean that they've got different sensory apparatus. It means they're attending to different things. And I think, as Joseph said, what we can do in sensory science and what we can do in multisensory design is to bring people's attention back to and give them pleasure in things they hadn't noticed. And you brought up an interesting distinction that I think we should sort of nail straight away. When people talk about, you know, is it tricky? Is it manipulative? I think there's a difference, big difference between leading and misleading. You can lead people to things that are there. You can get them to enjoy them more and attend to them. But I will never work for a company who want me to mislead, to try to convince people there's something there that isn't there. That's not right. I think you want to bring out and enhance and lead people to what they are supposed to get, given the expectations you're providing in a sensory way.
There is, without doubt, sensory science can alter the perceived reality of the consumption occasion. What we are trying to do with the companies we work with, the brands we work with, is to place a lot of emphasis on that alignment. So what is the expectations that are being elicited by the branding, the packaging? Because there are many products that are being developed according to, just about right on acidity and sweetness and salt, but less about the meaning of those sensory cues and how they line up with the expectations.
And you've been doing lots of work on packaging as well.
Absolutely.
Right? So tell us a little bit about what the importance of packaging is to the multisensory experience.
Well, I think one trick that sensory science again can bring to the party is thinking about packaging as body language. So at the moment, a lot of packaging relies on the communication hierarchy, shelf pop, etc. But less energy has been directed towards creating packaging that communicates vital brand equities sort of subliminally, you know, sort of system one type thinking. So the structures, the substrates, the weights, etc., of packaging that can serve the brand positioning.
The feel as well, presumably.
I think, for example, a great example of packaging that accentuates the positioning is the Kraken. I mean, Lord only knows how much they spent on that bottle. but it looks like it's been dredged from the sea, from a 300-year-old shipwreck. But it accentuates this idea of being from a seafaring heritage rum, and it works very well with the dark liquid inside, which reflects the fact that the brand story is all around this mysterious creature that lives in the dark depths of the ocean.
Like,
so they've aligned their liquid, the colour, to the story.
Yeah.
And it's about 10 Pantone references darker than the nearest rival. But they can get away with it because they've done it holistically. The packaging, the branding, the product.
I think that's really important, that idea of holistically. I think in order for these things to work, there has to be meaning behind them. It can't just be randomly changing colours or textures or sounds. It has to all fit together
holistic,
as a part of a meaningful
congruent. It's got to be congruent. So we know that every sensory cue is also linked to other sensory expectations. And if you line them up, then people like it because it's easier to process. If you get them to clash with one another, it's incongruent.
Yeah.
People's expectations are violated. I mean, another example of packaging is that waxy feel to cartons of smoothies. Now, smoothies are gloopy liquids, but if you've got that waxy feel on the outside, your fingers are almost giving you the expectations for the tongue about what the texture will be like.
I like that.
I have another word for this congruence, which is authenticity. So if manufacturers are besotted with, as are consumers, with authenticity, my argument is how can you be authentic if you're not aligned?
I don't like that word anymore because Donald Trump is authentic. So he's devalued the currency a little bit.
That's a whole other podcast.
Charlotte, now you're kind of more at the building stage of this. You know, you're working with people, creating new products, you're supplying the ingredients themselves. When you get to the sort of granular level of choosing what you're going to put into it, the new consumer expectations about food, has that changed how you approach creating something new?
Yes, I think it has. But also, you have to look at what's driving the development of the product that you're looking at. We do an awful lot of work in sugar reduction, for example.
Yeah.
We use sugary aromas that don't actually taste sweet, and they can help as part of
so
a formulation.
So that's okay. So what you just said there, it's kind of messes with my head. Sugary and aroma. So sugary is a taste, but aroma is the smell. You're saying that there's a direct connection between the two.
Absolutely.
With what sort of substances? What sort of flavors are you looking at?
Sugar in itself.
Vanilla.
Vanilla, yes. There's a great demo you can do with vanilla. If you take some sugared water and just put some vanilla in one cup, about 95% of people will say that the one with vanilla in it tastes much sweeter. But it's just an aroma.
And yet vanilla's got no sugar in it. If you have a vanilla pod and eat it, it's bitter.
It's horrible. Yeah.
So it's a brain association between mixing vanilla aroma with things that do have sweetness on the tongue. Ice cream, chocolate, cake, custard, and so on.
Yeah.
But it is that congruency, cultural reference as well. So it has to be where you associate vanilla with sweetness. So if it's not something you associate with sweetness, then that effect won't work.
Southeast Asia, you associate it with salt. Mm-hmm. So you'd have people smelling a vanilla pod and they might say, smells salty.
Yeah.
So you've got to be careful.
Yeah. And so give us an example of how a product has been developed with what you've been working.
Well, we work with quite a range of customers, large consumer goods companies. The drive for, particularly in terms of the sugar reduction, for cutting out your sugar has become huge. Those companies have been looking at this for quite some time. And what they will do if they want to take an existing formulation, for example, things like the beverage tax, the soda tax, they want to bring the sugar down to below that 5 grams per 100 mils. So they will look at their formulation, they will take the sugar out, then taste it.
While
it tastes horrible.
While trying to maintain the illusion that it still is satiating.
Yes, absolutely. So, you can take the sugar down and then you need to start building it back up again, because taking sugar out changes so many other aspects of even a beverage, which really, is mostly water. Mm. But there are so many elements that sugar brings that you then have to build back up. And that's really where we start to include our ingredients. You need to add that sweetness back, that's important, but you also need to add things like mouthfeel and the aroma, the overall flavour perception as well, because sugar enhances the flavour as well.
And in there's a lot of innovation and new products when you talk about Kraken and things like that. And does the consumer have an endless amount of patience for brand new ideas, do you think? Are people getting...
Yes.
You reckon that they're just up for fun?
Well, I've been looking at some research done by the University of Washington, one professor, David Levy, and he's been studying the effect of our online lives. And he's saying that the effect of constant online stimulation is leading people to expect the same level of stimulation offline.
That's a big jump from experiences.
Popcorn brain, but basically what it means and what it means now is that even some of the larger manufacturers are getting involved in just producing stuff that's a little bit of a stretch. Whether it's the real extra sour chubby chumps in Europe or Marmite now in peanut butter from Unilever.
Yeah.
But I noticed something else recently, anecdotally, is I'm starting to notice a lot of blue food out there. Now, I've been in student drink for 20 odd years, and the rule was you never did blue unless you were Heinz or Benecol,
because
it was
a
medicinal.
Yeah. It's not a food colour.
But I'm starting to see, we've got Bolt from the Blue, from Innocent, there's lots of blue cakes.
This is playful, though.
It's adventurous, and people are seeking those things.
And so are people just seeking different?
Yes.
Or are they seeking something new that will be revelatory?
They're seeking new experiences. I mean, remember, we've gone from being goods and service economy to being an experience economy. It's the experience you want. You don't have the product, you have the experience of the product. And so people want new and better experiences. They want playful experiences. They want an experience that teaches them something about themselves as well as about what they're eating or drinking. Oh, look what happened to me. You said popping candy. First time you put that in your head and you think, my God, what's going on inside me?
Mm.
So you learn something about it, but you're also discovering something about how you can respond to it. And I think there's an appetite for that. People want to use themselves as a sort of playbook to try and get new and different and better experiences to become more discriminating.
Yeah.
And they want experiences that are shareable. They want to experience things that are different, that are new, that they can tell their friends about. And this is across the board, whether it's new products, new diets, new restaurants, new dining experiences, whatever it is. New holidays, where you speak to companies that run cruise lines, and they'll say, yep, the destination is kind of an important factor in it, but a bigger part is all the onboard experiences now that we can offer people that is just different from what they could have had they not come on the cruise. And, you know, food is one of the main kind of elements that's kind of, I guess, after, you know, Michelin star dining and fine dining became a bit more democratized after, I guess, 2009, you started having tasting lunch menus at, I don't know, £25-30. You could go to some one or two star places and get a half bottle of wine and two or three courses. Now people are looking at what's after that. What happens? What, you know, I've been to a great dining experience, been to a nice formal place, been to all the kind of amazing things that London has to offer, but now they're looking for more. They want that place where they have to kind of go and put in a secret code or knock on a door or receive the directions to the 24 hours in advance. It's about seeking out experiences that are, again, new, interesting, shareable.
And possibly transformative. I mean, they want to have got through that and feel that it's not the same as it was before. And all the advertising's about that. It's not a hotel, it's an experience. You know, this is what people are doing to you.
Which is both exciting and really dreary at the same time. At
some point. You have to live up to that.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so Charlotte, now, imagine. So what's the process? Are you getting lots of food producers coming to you saying, we just need something new? What can we do that's new? How can we shift this experience?
Yeah. Everybody wants the new, the drive for new.
How do you deal with that then?
You can always put a different twist on an old favourite. I mean, I'm sure, Joseph, you do that a lot. But, you know, it's really about understanding what the consumer wants, what your customer is looking to give that consumer. And then you can start to think about how you can put that new twist on it.
So are you throwing new flavours in? Are you playing with mouthfeel? What are the tricks?
That would be giving an awful lot of
God, money. Come on!
but yes, you know, throwing new flavours in, really looking at the way that the ingredients interact with the foodstuff that you're contributing the ingredient to. So all sorts of different ways.
And can you take scientific concepts and use them to try and build something from scratch? Or is it just mucking about with different substances and flavours and fragrances and sweetness? You know, is it random?
It's not random. You do start from a scientific basis.
You build it from scratch.
But I think flavour perception, enjoyment of food, hedonic response is so subjective, as we were talking about earlier. And it just is, there's... Unfortunately for me, I'm a scientist. Yeah. And
I think it's not subjective, by the way. I mean, I think we've got to be careful with this word, subjective, because... Subjective, if it just means a subjective experience that's happening to you, that's right. But I think there are objective facts about how we subjectively respond to various sorts of stimulants. You know, and we know a lot about that. We know which things are shared and which things are varied. So we know our taste buds are going to be different depending on the number of papillae we've got in our tongues. So you have super tasters who are very reactive to bitterness or saltiness, and other people who need a lot of stimulation to get the same effect. But that's individual difference. That's not subjectivity. You could have brands which actually target the foods they're giving to the palate of the user.
Does that happen now?
It doesn't, but I keep saying to people, Joseph's got this, but very few chefs have got it. If you have a tasting menu, you should start with a tasting strip. You should find out how people are reacting to the foods and then maybe pitch towards them so that they know what they're getting.
So it's like nutritional profiling. You're saying that you can get sort of sensory perception profiling.
You can get sensory perception profiling for sure. I mean, it's more difficult with odor. It's easier with the tongue. It's difficult with odor. But, you know, it's just not true that taste is completely subjective. You know, if somebody says to me, a banana tastes like an orange, then there's either something wrong with them or with the banana. You know, I just don't buy it.
So we're saying it's a different way of looking at it. It's just not. It's not random. It's... just difference,
There are a set of differences. But look, there's also some things that are universal and the same. So if we invite everybody here to put lemons on a scale between fast and slow, where are they? And everybody says fast. Everybody says fast. And that's universal. Banana, slow. Now, once you know that that's how people react, then you can utilize that to put it into expectations about what you're going to eat or the way in which foods will deliver. So I really think that, you know, we've got to be very careful. We've got to find out which things are individually different, which things are culturally different, which things are universal. And we can use that scientifically, and then we can build on that.
Yeah. We can, but I think now trying to tap into that mass market appeal is actually very, very difficult because there is such a range and such a range of different tastes and preferences, if you like.
So
and
preferences are subjective. I give you that. Look, here's a terribly bad argument that people always make. They say, you know, try this wine. Do you like it? And I say no, and you say yes. And they will say, well, it can't taste the same way to you as it does to me, because if it did, you'd like it just as much. Not true. It could taste exactly the same way to you and to me, and you like that flavor and I don't. So preferences are individual. But what we're interested in sensory science is finding out what are people's flavor perceptions? How do they perceive the flavors? And how do flavors work with one another? Take sugar reduction. So here's something that's a trick, if you like, but it's actually quite useful. I give people 95% cocoa solids chocolate, but it's stone ground. It's made in the old way, like pestle and mortar. So it's grainy, gritty, sandy in the mouth. Then I give them 100% lentil ground, very, very smooth chocolate. And then you say to them, which one seems sweeter? And they say the second. And you say, well, that's interesting, because that's 100% cocoa solid, whereas the other one's 95% cocoa solid, 5% sugar. But it turns out that the smoothness will bluff the brain into thinking it's sweeter. Now, that's the sort of stuff that everybody responds to, so you can utilize that.
Can we just talk a little bit about the big new developments in the food industry, which I think are pretty much the idea of plant-based alternative proteins, meats, healthier options of foods generally. What are the challenges facing people who, I would say that things like the Beyond Meat, the Beyond Burger and things like that are really trying to emulate what a normal meat burger is like, including taste and texture. What are the big challenges with getting people to eat these things and enjoy it? What's the sensory perception challenge there?
Well, I think it starts with the branding and the packaging. You want packaging that evokes meat cues.
Which is what
well, probably blacks and reds, you know. There's Garden Gourmet, product that's been launched in the US, Europe, UK. It's actually been withdrawn from the UK. And commentators are suggesting that the predominant sort of green execution of the packaging was therefore failing to attract the flexitarians. The market for these plant-based products is not vegan. It is flexitarianism. The vegan percentage of the population is very small. So the reason Beyond Burger is so successful is because it's appealing to those flexitarians, and it's got a product that, I know it's got about 22 ingredients, but it's really perfected that texture, hasn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, products like the Beyond Burger, the Greg's sausage roll, they're so good now that your true vegan is actually put off. You know, they think they're being hoodwinked into eating the real thing. So I think, yes, you've got to know your target, and that target should be flexitarian if you're going to have a big business out of it. And then develop to those meat cues as Beyond Burger has done really well.
It is actually a tricky thing, because you know you're trying to say to people the Impossible Burger, which I've had and which I think is very, very successful. You're trying to say to people, look, it's just like eating a burger. But people who really don't want to eat meat for all sorts of reasons, as you say, for ethical reasons, they don't want to say, let's have as close as possible as I get to it. So you're right. You're converting people who would rather have meat to having an experience that tastes to them as good as having meat, but they're having it plant-based. Here's a challenge, though. The Impossible Burger, you know, the gourmet burger and so on, highly processed. Now, you tend to get people who have the following pair of, you know, thoughts. We should eat more plant-based foods. We don't want so much processed food. And you think, well, maybe you can't have it both ways. If you're going to have more processed food to deliver plant-based food, isn't that a good thing? So if you, you know, if you've got these competing principles, I think you're going to be in trouble. Because, you know, we're not going back to the Paleolithic diet. We don't have Paleolithic jaws, and our gut isn't, you know, designed to deal with it. So, you know, there's a choice there. Yeah. Maybe you have to go processed.
And I think consumers are actually becoming much more aware now of the level of processing that goes into these foods. There was an article in the Times this morning, actually, about the ingredients that go into these the meat alternatives. And the tone of it was very, oh, these are all nasty chemicals, and actually a lot of them are still plant-derived ingredients.
Yeah. Also, processing is cooking, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, isn't it, Joseph? I mean...
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to, I guess, education in terms of being able to look at what's going into foods and understand them. And I think a lot of people don't understand when they look at a lot of these kind of alternative ingredients that are going in, whether they fully understand what that means.
But have you dealt a lot with sort of the trying to replicate the meat experience using...
No, not really, because I think one of the interests... So why is it that we're constantly trying to replicate meat? Surely there's enough that we can do with vegetables. I understand the whole flexitarian part, that that's a big part of getting people who are looking for that meat hit but trying to find an alternative way of providing it. But I don't think that's necessarily a very sustainable way of getting people to convert to a more plant-based diet. That's maybe offering better alternatives, but I think if it's more a shift in people's lifestyle and perception and, again, education and knowledge of what to do with vegetables, because a lot of people just aren't cooking as much at home and just don't know what to do with raw ingredients. And then you have all sorts of problems with even children growing up now having not being able to identify ingredients, knowing what processed foods like hummus are, but not being able to identify a chickpea. And it's just that disconnect that we have between us and our sources of food. And I think, again, just trying to replicate things like burgers is not maybe the way of trying to educate people into having a healthier diet. I think it's just offering them what is being marketed at the moment as being a really maybe sustainable alternatives.
It's a huge industry, though, isn't it? I'm just reading something from an industry magazine that says that we reckon it'll be $140 billion industry within a decade. So it's, whether we sort of like it or not, it's going to be really important. And I think we should actually bring things back to this. So a lot of our listeners, I think, will be food industry professionals, and they'll be thinking, what can I do with this information? How can I fit it into work? What do you think, let's start with Andy, actually, what do you think's on the horizon for novel food experiences, for the integration of the understanding of sensory perception in building new products? It's a tricky question. There's all components of that.
Well, one of the things that drives a lot of my speeches on the conference circuit is this search for meaningful distinctiveness. So, yes, having brands that deliver products, compelling products, but there is searching for that small sensory detail that, if you like, communicates everything about the experience, the backstory. I talk a lot about Duchecco spaghetti, which is in a very commoditized category. So, and the reason I use this is because I think if it can be done there, it can be done anywhere. When you look at the Duchecco spaghetti, it's very flat from an aerial view. And that translates to consumers as, oh, it's been cut. You know, they start moving their hands in a sort of cutting motion, as opposed to being mass extruded. So instantly, this product is seen as being a little bit more distinctive, authentic. It's augmented by the fact that the pasta is also mottled as you look along the line of the spaghetti strands, and it's rough to touch. And combined all of these things, they're not just distinctive, but they're meaningfully distinctive because they are translating a lot about that brand and the way it does things. It's transmitting things like it's genuine, it's passionate, it's individual, without communication being known to take place. So I think the opportunity for brands is to create compelling products which, with a sensory pop, whether it's through texture or new tastes or stretching the consumer's palate, but doing it with that attention to the small details. And I do believe that we're at a point where the consumer is now, you know, a sleuth, they're micro analyzing things more than ever before, perhaps because of the way that we're being rewired through the internet. Searching for that meaningfully distinctive characteristic.
Yeah, and it's a holistic approach.
And I think that has to be done because there is so much mediocre out there at the moment. Products that are okay, but they're not fulfilling their true potential. So I think it's time for manufacturers to dig deeper, and I believe it's this meaningful distinctiveness that should underpin that.
Okay. Barry, is there any particular research that you know of that you think will be more and more important to people creating new products?
Yes. I mean, I do think that creating new products for particular groups or particular places matters. So the elderly, we know as you get older, your sense of smell diminishes. That's contributing so much to what we call flavour, that people are beginning to say, you know, we've got a big problem coming. People are living longer but not enjoying their food as much. And we all know elderly people who say, oh, the food doesn't taste as good as it used to. And what do? They put more salt on it, which increases the risk of stroke, heart disease. Very bad idea. So we have to make the food more interesting, using texture, using spices, trigeminal stimulants, all sorts of things. But we have to do that in a clever way, because if you take smell out, it's not as though, you know, everything else stays the same. So that's one environment. The other environment is in the air. So as Joseph said, you know, people are competing on price. And I think as we're required to fly less and the cost of flying will be greater, the thing that will distinguish airlines is how good their in-flight service is. And of course, you're at high altitude, low pressure, dry air, white noise in your ears, all of this affecting your ability to taste food. Anybody who can work very well to deliver something that performs well in that environment is going to be on a winner. So I think it's looking at patients in hospitals, looking at people undergoing cancer treatment, it's looking at the elderly with a loss of smell. These are the places where you could really make a big difference to designing good, nutritious, desirable, enjoyable food.
And it's not just making the experience sort of more fun and interesting. That's quite vital.
It's making people really eat. Important. I mean, there is a problem called geriatric anorexia, which is when people do get older and lose their sense of smell, not wanting to eat. It's a big problem. And nutritionists come along and say, here's what you need, and they give them gloop, and they don't want to eat it. And so people are now trying to work out how to make something sensorily satisfying, enjoyable, to make sure that they do eat the things they need. So this is important.
Yeah.
It's a quality of life thing as
it
well.
It's a quality of life thing for sure.
Even for people undergoing things like chemotherapy and lots of different types of treatments along those lines, the idea of being able to have foods that are palatable and enjoyable while you have a loss of your sense of smell or taste is...
Or oversensitivity in the mouth or mouth ulcers. You know, I think getting toolkits that provide what people need in certain conditions, that's the sort of sophistication that we hope the technology and getting more data from individuals willing to contribute to tell us what conditions they're in, we will be able to find matches and fits for them.
And just to think about it commercially for a second, it's a big emerging market, isn't it? We're an ageing population. It's not just helping. Yeah. There's DOSH involved there as well. Joseph, from your work, and what I'm fascinated by what you do is you've got the people right there, and you can see it. And it's not just, you know, a slide being lifted up, the plate being shoved in, and then finding out what the experience is. You've got the whole experience. Is there anything that you've experienced with your diners that you think could be translated into products that could be marketed differently? And is there an experience that you kind of go, oh, that, why didn't we, if I could bottle that, I could make my million?
I don't know if we've got the magic ingredient like that, but... look, what's been really interesting over the last kind of just under 10 years now of designing these types of experiences is that all of this sensory science. So what attracted me to this area was, you know, hearing the kind of work that Barry does and that Professor Charles Spence that was mentioned earlier does up in Oxford, and looking if we could take some of this and if it would actually work outside of the lab. And I can confirm after all this time that it is incredible how when we were talking things like, let's say, vanilla being able to make things appear sweeter, we see it time after time that spraying things like vanilla, caramel will make things like whiskey or wine or whatever it may be sweeter. You can see the impact that things like texture have on people's perception, association, enjoyment, and overall feeling towards a dish. And it could be the texture of the cutlery, it could be the texture of the food itself, it could be the texture of the plateware, but all of this has a really important bearing on how people enjoy an experience. And I think that's what it really comes down to, is designing the experiences, food experiences, to take into consideration more than just smell and taste and to look at those other kind of sensory elements as being part of what is going to result in either the consumer's enjoyment of the food or the product. And it, you know, there's some great research out there now, and it really does kind of come to life. And you're right, we get to see it kind of happen in front of us on a kind of daily basis, and it works.
Yeah. And Charlotte, this is another tricky one for you, I'm afraid. What do you think's on the horizon? I know you can't tell us what products you're working on and what's exciting, but what do you think's on the horizon, generally speaking, for new food experiences? Things that consumers want that you're beginning to build for them?
Well, I think there's an element of what consumers want, but also identifying those gaps in nutrition or need within the market. So coming back to what Barry was saying about the ageing population, that is a big drive for a lot of consumer goods companies. You also need to think about fibre. That's huge. That is actually a nutritional deficiency that we have in the Western world that we're really not addressing. We need to do more. How do we incorporate more fibre into our food but keep it tasting great, increase the nutritional value of that food? The plant-based thing is not going to go away. The meat alternatives, they're not going to go away. They're only going to get better and better, I think, as well. So there's a lot of opportunity out there.
Yeah. Okay, just to finish off then, I'd like to go around the table and ask you what you think the most exciting sort of product that has a sensory element to it that does something fun, whether it's the packaging that you love, whether it's the mouthfeel, whether it's something new. I mean, Charlotte, you were talking beautifully about the idea of the beer and the condensation around the outside. Is there something that for me it's popping candy, but what is there something that everyone's got that they feel is exciting? Andy, starting with you.
Well, I suppose because I saw an advert this morning, it's not new, but I think it's paving the way. Aperol Spritz. So it's definitely fun. I mean, the way it's marketed, that sort of breaks the evening, gets the evening off to roll. But the fact is that it's pushing palates towards bitterness. And with the sort of sensory void being opened up by the reduction of sweetness, I think anything that challenges consumers and bitterness, and I can't think of one that's brand new, but I think that what Aperol is doing is pushing people's tastes more in towards bitterness.
I think you're right, yeah. I think, yeah, so it's quite good. And they put a lot of effort into this new sensation. Okay, Barry?
So I think there's a lot of opportunity still for sonic branding. So think of some of the best brands you've got out there, like Kit Kat with its Snap, taking the lid off a Snapple bottle and it makes a suction noise, Magnum with a crack. Mm-hmm. So the Snap, Crackle and Pop now seems very old, but my God, Kellogg's were onto that very early.
That's very true.
And every kid put their ear down and listened to that noise.
I did it pretty much daily.
Daily, exactly. So I think, Kellogg's are actually quite sort of blasé and say, oh, that's so old-fashioned, but it's coming back. And I think better sonic branding is actually the way to go here.
Yeah. Okay, Joseph?
Well, in terms of new and interesting things, not products I've seen, but products I'm interested to see are things that are being developed for space. And there's an awful lot of work in this area now, looking at the sensor, if we're going to be traveling longer distances, we need to be eating better quality food. Space tourism, astronauts are happy with eating kind of anything, really. They're just happy to be up in space. But if you're paying millions to go up there, you want something better than freeze-dried ice cream as a treat. So
while your sinuses are so engorged, you can't smell anything, right?
Exactly. So there's so many alterations in your sensory perception of food and taste and flavor when you're in space that there's a lot of research now going towards that, looking at, well, how can we produce a taste of home for people when they are so far away? And a lot of sensory science and research is kind of starting to and design products. I mean, now you've got champagnes and beers, I know, that are all looking at how they can get that pop in space and how they can pour the perfect serve up there. So, yeah.
They're not just looking for PR, is that? Okay, Charlotte, what's your favourite product?
I think this touches on what Andy was saying earlier as well about stretching consumers' palates. The low, no alcohol space is really interesting from a multi-sensory perspective. You've got Seed Lip, very complex flavours, quite unique, quite interesting flavours that for some people are a bit of a challenge. And then if you look in the sort of reduced alcohol space, how do you take the alcohol out of an alcoholic beverage but still give that enjoyment. Mouthfeel is a big thing. If you take the alcohol out, you'll lose your mouthfeel. You do lose that slight warming. There's almost a slight trigeminal effect from the alcohol. Yeah. And the smell...
Then, how do you do it?
Solve
that problem for
come
us.
Come talk
right
to
now.
Us.
Natural thing. Exactly. Yes. Okay, so just to remind you, you've been talking to Barry Smith, Charlotte Catignani, Joseph Youssef, Andy Wardlaw, and I'm Stefan Gates. Thank you very much for listening in. Join you next time for the next Table Talk podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.